Well, those are the opening moments of the Second Symphony by Michael Tippett, completed in 1957. It sounds in that brand new recording from the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra conducted by Martin Brabbins, like hugely self-assured and thrilling music. But at its first performance, that piece broke down. And maybe this is as good a place as any to begin our conversation with Oliver Soden about the music and the life of Michael Tippett. Oliver Soden, welcome to The Music Show.
Oh, it's lovely to be here, remotely.
It's an amazing story now, really, when you hear that piece, isn't it? To think that it just fell apart after a minute or so.
I know, but I mean, part of you wants to forget all about the disastrous premiere because it only adds to the, in my view, false view that Tippett is a very challenging, problematic composer. In a way, you want to let the symphony sing by itself. But, you know, like Elgar's Dream of Gerontius or any other number of pieces that we now think of as masterpieces, it did have this amazingly difficult birth, and it took so long for people, audiences and performers alike, to accept what Tippett was doing. And of course, also, it makes a good story. And I delved into the BBC archives to listen to the surviving broadcast of the first performance, which was Adrian Bolt conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra in 1958. And after about 3 minutes, the whole thing, as you say, ground to a halt. And you can hear on the recording Adrian Bolt, very calm, very suave, turning to the audience and saying, "Entirely my fault, ladies and gentlemen." But whether that was actually true took an awful lot of listening very carefully to the broadcast, and I came to the conclusion that there is an awkwardness in Tippett's writing. We have to concede that. It's part of its glory in some ways. And it was very difficult for the orchestra to work out what he was doing, and a poor flautist came in a little bit too early and led a chain reaction of false cues, and the whole thing just, you know, the dominoes fell. But now, as Martin Brabbins proves with that recording you've just played, orchestras can rejoice in the eccentricity of the writing without thinking that that is necessarily a flaw in it. I mean, I think the opening of that symphony is one of the great openings to a symphony of all time.
Yes, I quite agree. And the reason I wanted to play it was for that reason, and also because it gets us straight into, if you like, the kind of the problem with Tippett. And it's not necessarily Tippett's problem, even if there is a degree of awkwardness in some of his writing. It's more to do with the problem of the way his music has been received. And that piece, you know, the second performance didn't go terribly well. And John Barbarolli and the Halle Orchestra, as you point out in your book, cancelled the third performance because Barbarolli didn't think it was worth his time.
Not worth the bother getting it right. But by the third performance, which was at the Albert Hall, the reviewers were starting to acclaim a masterpiece. There's something in the way Tippett writes, there must be something in the way any composer who is breaking new ground writes that takes a bit of time to for performers to get used to playing and for audiences to get used to listening. But I would argue that's part of the point, that's Tippett's glory rather than his failing.
It is, and although that reputation in a sense dogged him as he continued his work and his life, it also began to be, you know, it fell away, didn't it? Because the Corelli Fantasia had a similar start, and Malcolm Sargent refusing to have anything to do with it. And then it became a popular classic. And you mention in the book that you go to this rehearsal of The Ice Break, and here is a student student choir and a choir of volunteers who don't know who Tippett is and don't know that the music's meant to be difficult, and they're learning it by heart.
It was an amazing revival of that opera, the first in decades, the first in my lifetime, certainly, that was done here in England by the Birmingham Opera Company. And it was a site-specific production, so the chorus were running through the audience who were walking around this wonderful, disused factory. And as you say, because people had really forgotten that this was supposed to be a difficult, challenging opera, because the chorus, mainly made up of volunteers, were learning the music by ear rather than from a frightening looking score with hundreds of little black dots bristling all over the page, people just got on with it. And the next morning, the papers were acclaiming a masterpiece, whereas this late opera full of 1970s slang and gang warfare and so on had been thought to be irreparably dated. And yet somehow a good director, a good production, proved that actually even the late challenging operas of Tippett that were thought to be so embedded in the 60s and 70s and the politics of their time still have something to say to this world that seems more divided than ever.
Well, The Icebreak, of course, was actually dated at its first performance, and so in some senses, maybe it had transcended all of that by the time Graham Victor
exactly.
did his production.
Somebody who'd been there at the premiere in July 1977 at the Opera House in London said, how is it that an opera that had seemed dated at the premiere now seems so staggeringly relevant? And I think it has something to do with the fact that if Tippett as a composer wanted to be bigger than fashion, which all the great composers have to be, sometimes you have to risk being unfashionable. And it takes a little time for the operas to begin to travel through that very strange journey that operas have to do between being relevant and then being dated and then being a period piece and then being timeless. I think that takes quite a while. But then if you hold a mirror up to society, that will be transient. But if you hold a mirror up to humanity, there are going to be permanent issues that Tippett's music is always going to be speaking about with relevance and passion.
On today's music show, I'm speaking to Oliver Soden, who is the biographer of Michael Tippett. Michael Tippett, the biography, it's a big book, and the first biography, the first full biography of Tippett ever written, which is in itself slightly surprising, though it again perhaps feeds in to this impression that people, or some people, have carried around. There were criticisms of his late music. There was, after his death, the usual sort of falling away of interest that often happens with composers. And then the centenary, of course, came too soon because he died in his 90s, and there hadn't really been time for that post-mortem period to finish. But then your book has attracted quite a lot of varying reviews, hasn't it? And it's sort of brought out some of the haters again.
It was an odd experience. Varying reviews, dare I say, about Tippett's music rather than the book.
Not about your book, no.
No, exactly. Because they were quite nice, but it's an odd thing about the reviews because you aim for lofty indifference. And then actually the reality is that after spending 3 years writing about a composer I love, it's very difficult to read leading music critics still trotting out the same hoary old clichés without, it seemed to me, really listening to what Tippett was doing, or without realising the irony that all of the early works of Tippett that they now acclaim as masterpieces were in themselves totally denigrated when they appeared. You know, they seem to miss the fact that in dismissing late Tippett, they risk making the mistake of the first critics who dismissed the more permanent early works he wrote, such as A Child of Our Time, which is really immortal as a choral work, and the Concerto for Double String Orchestra, and so on. I think partly it's a generational thing. I'm 29. I wasn't there. I didn't attend any of those first premieres. I didn't see any of those first productions that had, you know, glorious 70s tie-dyed trousers and psychedelic sets and so on. I think I am able to come to the late music with a fresher eye. I'm not relying on 50-year-old memories for my views of this work.
Let's pause for a little bit of music. We'll go back now to the early 1960s, and this is the moment in Tippett's career where his star is rising. In fact, it's not only rising in its own regard, but it's rising particularly in comparison to Benjamin Britten. It's the opening of the new cathedral at Coventry, the big arts festival, the premiere of the War Requiem, which garnered quite a few lukewarm reviews at the time, and the premiere of Michael Tippett's opera, his second opera, King Priam, which got pretty much rave reviews. We'll listen to the end of Act Two, and this is Achilles and his war cry in the Trojan Wars. That's the end of Act Two of Michael Tippett's opera King Priam, and that was Robert Teare as Achilles, the London Sinfonietta and chorus conducted by David Atherton. And on today's music show, I'm talking to Oliver Soden, who has written a big, thick biography of the composer Michael Tippett, and it's the first biography of Michael Tippett. That still packs quite a punch, that music, doesn't it, Oliver?
Oh, it's terrifying. I mean, it's sheerly terrifying. And if you imagine that small Belgrade theatre in Coventry, where it was premiered, much smaller than the Opera House in London, where it eventually transferred, ricocheting around the wall. And, I mean, King Priam, I think, for me, by quite some way, is Tippett's greatest opera. I think it's a masterpiece. And the shock in 1962... Not so much the musical shock, because in some ways what Achilles is doing there is there isn't much you won't find in Monteverdi, but Tippett asks for it to be electronically amplified above the male chorus and above the brass pounding into the earth beneath. And just the sonic shock of that in 62, the daring, I think, must have been quite striking. And, well, I still think it is. It's such a brilliant... act opener in the middle of that terrifying, tragic opera.
And it's also a bit of a shock if you thought you knew Tippett at that particular point, because Tippett, you might have believed to be a rather florid contrapuntalist based on any number of pieces, including his first opera, The Midsummer Marriage. And this is a pugnacious punch in the face of a piece, isn't it?
Completely. I think one thing I admire about Tippett is his refusal to carry on doing the things he was best at, the way he went back to square one and taught himself a new technique for each new phase in his composition. And I think this might explain some of the antipathy towards his music. He really disdained his own facility. So, as you say, a big clutch of amazing contrapuntal invention in his earlier pieces, and then this great, shining, radiant first opera, The Midsummer Marriage, which is just this sea, this river of dazzling lyricism. And then with the second opera, choosing the stagnation, the violence of the Trojan War, partly as a statement from the overarching pacifist that he was, it dictated a whole new musical style. So he explodes the orchestra into shrapnel, really. You know, there's very little development. The score is a mosaic of amazingly inventive, non-developing, stagnating motifs, with the singers kind of jaggedly rowing with one another over the top. It's a completely new style, and yet, in some ways, it's so unmistakably Tippett. The invention is still there. If the style is different, the voice is the same, I would say.
I mentioned Benjamin Britten before, and Britten, of course, is an very important figure in this book and in Tippett's life. He was a little bit younger than Tippett, and he died quite a bit before Tippett. So Tippett's life sort of embraces Britten's. And of course, Britten was in many ways the opposite, musically in many ways. I mean, there was never any suggestion that Britten wrote clumsy music or difficult music. He was a supremely facile composer in the best sense.
In the sense of having facility,
yes. Yeah. And so there's a tremendous contrast there. And they remain pretty good friends most of the time. But the other great difference, of course, is in their sexuality. I mean, they were both gay, but differently gay. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about Tippett's coming to terms with homosexuality.
Well, I was quite interested exploring the darker reaches of his sexual life, partly because he would introduce himself to people as bisexual, which was a surprise to, you know, to people who knew him very much as an out and proud gay man in the last decades of his life. I was intrigued by how many probably non-sexual but nevertheless passionate love affairs he'd had with women. I was intrigued by the number of women he'd asked to marry him, not least Ray Vaughan Williams' widow Ursula and the great composer Pryo Rainier. And I don't think that these were questions of marriages of convenience either. The most important love affair, and I think it was a love affair that he had in his life, was with a female novelist and music editor called Francesca Allanson. Yes. So he's much less exclusively gay than Britain in that regard.
And he desperately wanted children as well.
Exactly. It's a very 21st century attitude. It's not about being different. It's about wanting the rights and the domesticity and the legal protection and the parenthood that now is permitted to same-sex partnerships, which were then not. I mean, not being able to have children, not being able to have a settled marriage with a male partner is one of the great tragedies of his life, in a way. But there were passionate, complicated, tangled, destructive love affairs with men all the way through his life, which he nevertheless greeted with a great joy and openness in a way that Britain, we might say, was not able to do. Britain had that domestic long-term relationship with Peter Pears, but nevertheless, I mean, I'm not a Britain scholar, but other Britain scholars have written about that carapace of sexual unease that Britain existed beneath in some ways. And it's generally agreed that he was sexually celibate for most of his life. And that can, I mean, a critic of Britain's music might hear that sexless quality in it. Tippett found him as a person, and he didn't necessarily mean this pejoratively, but he called him sexually quite sterile. Whether you hear that in the music, I'm not sure. But there's nothing in Tippett of that sense in Britain one so often gets of the sexual, the political outsider. Tippett's operas won't boil down into that allegory that Britain's operas so often become of Peter Grimes, the conscientious objector, the homosexual, the outsider. That doesn't permeate Tippett's music in the same way, because in the end, his sexuality wasn't a huge issue for him. I think he was looking to exist in a world where sexuality might not need a prefix and where people fell in love with people. And good on him.
Good on him. And also, of course, far from being repressed, I mean, his operas at least, well, the later operas, have their high camp moments, don't they?
Yes, I think they do, in the Sontag sense of camp as theatricality and of play acting. I think there's been a danger in productions of his operas to play up a campness that isn't there. So his third opera, The Knot Garden, which was begun in 1962 when he sketched out the libretto, which contains a mixed-race, same-sex partnership between a composer and a playwright, and which, when it was staged in 1970, contained a kiss between two men. It's thought to be the first homosexual kiss on the operatic stage. One of those moments that nudges the world a little, I think. And especially if you think of the libretto being written before the legalization of homosexuality in this country, which came in 1967, before the abolishment of the Lord Chamberlain's right to censor works on the operatic stage, which came in 68, he's not only defying convention, he's defying criminal law. We have a lot to thank him for in that regard. But nevertheless, when the same-sex couple were put on the stage in 1970, there they were wearing pink socks and a feather boa, and all the reviews the next morning referred to the gay boys, quote unquote. So, I long for a production with a 21st century sensibility that will actually take what Tippett is doing with that couple at face value, rather than having to put them over in a pink feathery box, which is a stereotype we don't need anymore, I would say.
No, I think so. Let's have a little more music. One of the pieces that you, I know, are very close to is Tippett's Third Symphony, and it happens to be a favourite of mine as well. I remember hearing the first performance of it on the radio, and it's remained a favourite piece of mine. Let's listen to a part of the... It's in two big movements. We'll listen to part of the second movement, and we'll hear Heather Harper, the soprano, singing a slow blues.
Thank you.
Heather Harper, the soprano, with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Colin Davis. That's from the first recording of Tippett's Third Symphony. And the sound of that flugelhorn and those bluesy notes is something we should talk about. I think Oliver Soden, as Tippett's biographer, one of the issues, of course, that you have to confront is kind of is the accusation of trendiness.
Yes. It's hard to unpick what's going on here because I think there are so many complexities. I think critics have very dangerously equated the expression of one of Tippett's characters with the expression of Tippett himself. There's a difference between Tippett as a composer being trendy and Tippett as a composer depicting somebody's trendiness and in some ways criticizing it. I always point out that the use of 70s slang, which is so criticized in his late operas, is not Tippett himself using slang. It's a character showing an allegiance to a transient fashion or a clique, which soon enough brings about their own downfall. I think he's quite critical as a composer of trendiness. But sometimes when you're exploring trendiness, you have to yourself risk being trendy. That Third Symphony with the flugelhorn as a contemporary parallel to Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong, you know, duetting Louis Armstrong on the cornet. The blues for Tippett was one of the archetypal sounds of the 20th century, as, say, the fugue might have been to the 18th century, or he found it a terribly moving expression, not only of suffering, but of a way of alleviating suffering. You sang the blues to stop yourself feeling blue. So he puts a set of blues into the final movement of a vocal symphony as Beethoven might have put a fugue into the final movement or a Turkish march into the final movement of a symphony.
And I should have mentioned that he of course, introduces the blues with the same gesture that Beethoven used in his Ninth Symphony.
Well, yes, this is, I think, partly why the Third Symphony of Tippett means so much to me. It's almost, dare I say it, a moral importance, as well as a musical one. I so often admire Tippett as an intellect and as a thinker, maybe even as a visionary. So the astonishing final dramatic scena of the Third Symphony begins with a quotation from Beethoven's Ninth, the so-called Terror Fanfare that opens the finale to Beethoven's Ninth. And then Tippett puts a match underneath it. He explodes it, and the poor soprano has to, as it were, pick her way through these broken bits of Beethoven. And I think what Tippett is doing is asking, in a way very few other creative artists of the 20th century asked, whether what Beethoven and Schiller in that Ninth Symphony had to say about the permanence and enlightenment of universal brotherhood and the Ode to Joy and so on has any lasting relevance in the 20th century in the face of the concentration camps and Vietnam and Hiroshima and so on. You know, how on earth is it possible to perform the Ode to Joy in a world that has seen such terror and horror? And Tippett eventually decides that it is possible, but not without this long, arduous struggle. He wrote his own words for the soprano to sing. And although he's much criticized as a librettist, I admire those verses for a symphony very much. And she sings, they sang that when she waved her wings, the goddess Joy would make us one, which is a paraphrase of the Schiller. And then she goes on to say, and did my brother die of frostbite in the camps? And was my sister charred to cinders in the oven? We know not so much joy for so much sorrow. I find that so moving, the way he's able, in front of our ears, if you like, to take the joy of Beethoven, to explode it, and then rebuild it again. I think I'm getting towards saying that so much of what appeals to me in Tippett is the way he drags the listener, or often demands that we follow him through this darkling, shadowy terrain, only to bring us out into the light and ecstasy at the other side. I think that is somehow why I find him so important.
Your book, you didn't know Tippett, as you say, and you weren't around, really, for his career, but You put yourself in the book from time to time. There are diary moments, and one of them is when you're in Birmingham at that rehearsal of The Ice Break. And the last one is incredibly touching. Could you tell us about it?
Well, I'm so pleased you You think so, because I'm wary of those biographers who write books about themselves rather than about their subjects. But I spent a long time trying to track down Tippett's live-in carer, Andrew Costa, who had known him better than anybody, you know, hauling him after he'd had a terrible stroke on and off the commode and so on for nearly 2 years. And he spoke to me very openly and movingly about his friendship with Tippett as well as his professional involvement with him. And right at the end, he just said, I just want to show you something. Just close your eyes and put your hands out. And he put into my hand this very small red Tupperware container, and he took the lid off and I looked down. And of course, I knew exactly what it was going to be before he told me. There was just a little grey powder at the bottom. And somehow, as any son might do for his father, he had held back a portion of Tippett's ashes after he was cremated and kept them. And there I was, holding them in my hand. And I thought that was a very curious, rather moving, almost absurd introduction to this man in whose life I had swum around for the last 3 years and who I'd never met. And there he was in my hand. It was rather sad and forlorn and incredible.
Yes, incredible, and a wonderful ending to the book as well. I enjoyed reading it very much. Oliver Soden, thank you for being my guest on The Music Show and for talking about Michael Tippett. It's been a pleasure to hear your insights.
Oh, well, and a pleasure for me too. Thank you so much.
The closing moments of Michael Tippett's fifth string quartet, played by the Heath Quartet. Oliver Soden's book, Michael Tippett, the biography, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. And that's it for today's music show. Go to our webpage. You can find some of the stories that you might have missed over the last few weeks, or indeed you can listen again to today's programme. And you can always subscribe to the Music Show's podcast via the ABC Listen app. I'm Andrew Ford. The show is produced this week by Penny Lomax, Ellie Parnell and Jeff Wood. Technical production by Simon Branthwaite. Next week, we'll be talking to Archie Roach about his memoir, Tell Me Why, and the new double album, which shares its name. And we'll celebrate the life of the Australian conductor John Currow, who has just died. He was the founder of the Australian Youth Orchestra and an inspiration to generations of Australian musicians. Also, next week, we'll have one last hero for the year. Deborah Conway will be talking about Leonard Cohen.